And welcome to another episode of UFOs and the Paranormal Over Our Heads. I'm your host, Preston Dennett, and each week we bring you exciting new guests to talk about various aspects of UFOs and the paranormal. We had a pretty unusual show last week. Our guest was Gary Wimmer, W-I-M-M-E-R, and he talked about lithomancy. Lithomancy is the art, the psychic art of reading stones, like tarot, like palmistry, things like this, tea leaf reading. This is what lithomancy is, but it's working with stones to foretell the future and things like this. He had some interesting things to say, and if you didn't get a chance to listen to the show, remember all the shows are archived on the BVS website. So check it out if you get a chance. I think you might find it pretty interesting. Tonight, we're going back to my favorite subject, the subject I think that is really having a huge, profound effect on society, even though a lot of people don't realize it, and that is UFOs. I think this is one of the most important subjects today, and I think we're going to be seeing a lot of changes in how people view this phenomena in the future, as more and more evidence is uncovered and more people come forward with their stories. And tonight we are very honored to have a guest. His name is Ruben Sierra, and he's actually had quite a number of encounters, starting with an early childhood and continuing to the present time. And his stories are really quite extensive, involving not only sightings but apparently some face-to-face contact and the whole gamut. There's a lot of witnesses who have seen what he has seen, and his story is actually getting a lot of attention from the UFO community. He's appeared on Jeff Rentz's show, Sightings, on Brian Vike's show. He's recently been contacted by the History Channel, who's also interested in what he has to say. I've interviewed him several times, and I can tell you his story is definitely very involved and very interesting, and one of the more unique ones that I have heard. And so I want you all to give a nice warm welcome to our guest tonight, Ruben Sierra. Ruben, thank you so much for coming on to the show.
Yes, Preston, it's so good to hear from you again, and I want to thank you for affording me the opportunity to be on your show on the show today, and I'm sure it's going to be quite an interesting show.
Yeah, sorry about the short notice, but I'm really glad you were available because, you know, like I was saying in the intro, you do have an amazing story, which I think is really important. And if people knew what was going on, I mean, goodness, I don't think that even a lot of people within the UFO community realize some of the things that are going on, like in your story. But let's just start with the beginning, how it all began for you. I think your first encounter was involving lights in the sky where you had a flashlight?
Yes, basically it was a childhood abduction case, and it took place at the Hanson Dam at the base of the Angeles National Forest near Tujunga, the Tujunga rivers. And this took place in 1952-1953. I was 65, 6 years old. And we were helping a lady friend of my mother's move from one location to another location. And she had given me in one of the boxes an air mechanics industrial flashlight. And while the ladies were upstairs packing up the boxes to move to a different location, I took the flashlight up to the third floor, and basically I saw a light that was on the base, on the rim of the actual dam itself. And so I pointed this industrial high intense flashlight at the rim of the dam, and I just pressed it 2 or 3 times, and for every press I gave, it responded with the exact number of flashes that I would give to this light that was on the top of the dam itself.
Right.
And so it was responding to me. my mother at that point happened by, and she told me not to do that. That would might make this airplane, she called it, crash, you know, or fall down. That she was just trying to get a 6-year-old off the third story of the apartment houses. But basically, that's how it started with the, lo and behold, it wasn't an aircraft flying by. It was a UFO that was actually on the rim of the Hanson Dam itself. And this particular area, it was in the mid-50s to the mid-60s, it was a hotbed of UFO sightings. And they actually called it, this place is located near the San Fernando Valley, and it was known as the UFO landing bases. So basically that's how it started off for me. The very next day, about 11 o'clock in the morning, I was with my two brothers and two cousins and a number of other children. And we were outside, and I glanced over to one of the... And the I noticed a craft that was actually oscillating on one of the, off of the small road. And so it came over, it left the hill and just floated right over to the housing area. And this was government housing area. It floated right over to us, and it came to about 80 feet over our head, over our actual head. And it just stood there stationary. My older cousin waved at it, and my older brother actually waved at it, and it actually tilted itself in a downward motion. So we saw the actual, my brother called them portholes, but they were like square windows in the circumference of the actual craft itself. Right. And that's when we first saw the face-to-face alien beings there. And it righted itself, and it went down a service drive, and it went back to the Hanson Dam area where the previous night where it first showed itself to me when I flashed the light to it. And the children and my cousins and my brother, we went up to the craft itself.
Now, when you were looking through these portholes at these figures, did they look like normal people?
Well, at first, from the inside of the craft, what I noticed, I used to be a welder for about a little over 10 years, and I guess people have seen welder's hoods. It's, you know, it's like a complete, you know, your head's in an enclosure, and it has a little square opening where you can see your eyes to be protected from the actual arc. And it seemed to me that what I saw in the middle of the craft, along five, I took to be military-type alien beings, because the garb that they were wearing, it seemed to be military attire, and they all had some protective hoods over them, and they came to the windows first, and they looked, and they glanced down at us. Then, in unison, they pulled back, and then the classic grays, then they came forward, and that's what I first noticed. Ever seen the alien beings or the military type of beings that present themselves first?
Right. Wow.
Okay. Do you want me to continue?
Yeah, please.
Okay. Well, basically, Preston, like I told you before, at that point, the children, for some reason, as we were looking at the actual craft itself, because when they left the housing area, it went to the not to the rim of the dam, but to the base of the dam this time, and it flew over after when it was first stationary over our heads. It went down a service drive and then actually went over a playground area that they had for the children at the government housing, and it rested itself in a 45-degree angle at the base of the dam itself. We all went up to it, and there must have been at least seven of us children, two brothers and two cousins, and the rest were just children from the actual housing project itself. And we went up to the craft itself. it landed and it rested itself in a 45 degree angle at the base of the dam, and it and so we looked at it and we were just walking around it. We were far enough away from the housing project where the adults couldn't see us, and so we had a little bit of time by ourselves to look at the craft itself. But once again, it seemed in unison, all the children at one time, they just got up immediately, went to their bikes, and went back to the housing project. And I remained there by myself at the base of the dam with the craft itself. I felt it. I put my hand on the actual craft. It wasn't hot. It wasn't cold. It was had somewhat of a high polish to it, but it was not slippery. And so I put my knee on the I put my left knee, if I remember right, on the craft itself, and reminding you, it was rested on a 45 degree angle, and I started to crawl the circumference of the craft itself. When I got up to the top of the craft of a 45 degree angle, I didn't slide inward, and I didn't lose my footing at all, because it wasn't slippery. It was just had an odd texture, and it was, even though it was highly polished, I would not slip inward into the craft itself. Worked myself down to the opposite side of the craft, and I got to the bottom of it. When I got to the bottom of it, then I noticed there was an opening, a very dark opening at the very bottom of the craft. And I looked inside it, and I looked to the right as far as I could. And that's when I first noticed these lights. The lights were the color of a gold, pinks, magentas, very beautiful type lights. But what I noticed was, the lights, they were blinking off and on, but they also was kind of raising up and down, like when a person, when you're at rest, either watching TV on your sofa or whatever in bed, how your chest rises up and down. That's right. What the actual lights were doing. They were rising up and down, up and down. And so I began to crawl. They were so beautiful that I began to crawl towards the lights. And then I, there was a grating, the type of grating that you see, like maybe in the wintertime in New York, where steam comes up. For people who are in the New York area, they'll know what I'm talking about. When hot steam comes on out of the sidewalk and there's a grating. Well, that's what I remember touching. And then I immediately went down into the inside of the craft, and, at that point, I don't know how long I was inside the craft itself. I remember the beams went behind like a panel area, which was a very blue in color, and they were just looking at me, and they were. And I wasn't afraid, for some reason. I don't know if they relaxed me, made me relax, but I was not afraid. I didn't panic. And, I think from what my cousins and my brother told me, I must have been inside at least 45 minutes until I found myself out of the craft and walking back to the, government housing project where we had, you know, apartments. And, and then I regrouped with the children at that time.
Wow.
Later, towards the evening hours, the craft came back and presented itself again. And at this time, the adults were outside. Back in the 50s, in the early 50s, the mid 50s, all the adults would come out, you know, because we didn't have air conditioning back then, and they would come out, and all the kids would play, you know, around, you know, their apartments, and these government housing projects, they were like, somewhat like military barracks. Barracks. That's how they were made. They were three-story buildings, and they had apartment units in there, and then had grass in the middle, and another three-story unit, and then grass in the middle, and it went down just all the way, almost towards the dam area.
Right.
And we were, my brothers and cousins, they were playing hide and seek at that time. And it's a game we used to play in the, back in the 50s. And since I was last to regroup with the children, they told me to hide, you know, to, they were going to hide and I was going to try to find them because I was the last one to regroup with the actual children who were with me in the, you know, in the early part of the day. And, I did that and I, they told me to count backwards from 100 and in front of a telephone post. While I was doing that, I got back to the number of around, let's say 75 from 100 counting backwards and I fell into a stupor. An actual, like I just went into an actual deep sleep, like a stupor. And when I awoke, I found myself on the top of the third story rooftop area of the buildings. And I could actually hear the children where they were hiding. And then I would just appear in front of them. And I would take them to back to the, what we had a station. We had like an inner tube and that was, where we were going to bring the children back for this particular game. And I would start to walk to find the other children and I would find myself immediately back into the, to the roof of the apartments itself, the third story roof apartments. And, so basically this, case started to involve levitation at this point. And, I did this until I heard fear, fright, and the children's voice. And right. So the game broke up. At that point, the game broke up and, my parents came back and, took us from the area and I went back, with them. But at this prior to, just after the game breaking up, the UFO at that point, the same one that was at the base of the dam presented itself again. It actually flew over the government housing project. It circled it, went around the complete, Handsome Dam, area where the government project was, located. And the adults were there. And it looked at first like it was just like a big, basketball, like a ball, and about the size of a basketball. And it would just circle and circle the housing project. When it got right over to where we were standing with the adults, then it immediately elongated itself from a small basketball size into a craft. It just grew, it would actually overlap the rows and rows of the housing units itself. I remember hearing the women saying, you know, is it an airplane? And the men were saying, no. Someone said it's a helicopter. And then the men again were saying, no. Get the children inside the apartments. Take the children in the apartments. And so the adults took charge and started to gather all the children who were out that night. And because they knew this was something completely different that nobody had ever seen, and they wanted to make sure the children were going to be okay. But when the craft would circle the actually housing units, it overlapped both of the rooftop areas, and the lights that we saw and with the adults were the exact same morning when I went into the craft originally.
Wow, this thing was big then.
Yes, it was. It was. It was so big that it wrapped the apartments, rooftop to rooftop.
Wow.
At that point, my parents came. They were out shopping at a mom and pop type store, and they took us back. I was inside my aunt's and uncle's apartment, and they came and they gathered myself and my brother and my sisters, and they took us back to our own apartment unit. And the adults were trying to explain what had just transpired, but they couldn't absorb it. It just didn't make any sense to them. Even when the adults are trying to tell them, you know, because this is one of the first times that the UFO phenomenon was showing itself, you know, in 1952 at this great magnitude, and So I went back with my parents, and we went, they put us, myself and my brother, to bed, of course. And, around 3 o'clock in the morning, Preston, we were pretty much a poor family, and, my older brother had his own bed, and my younger brother and myself slept in one bed. And, I remember around 3 o'clock in the morning, that I began to, I heard a high-pitched noise and saw like a blue light inside the apartment bedroom. And I was laying down in a prone position, you know, and with my face looking up at the ceiling. And I actually began to levitate off the bed and go down the hallway. I went down the hallway, and there was a door there, and I thought, because I couldn't move no part of my body, I could only move my eyes, and I knew the planning of the actual housing unit itself in my bedroom. Of course, I knew where everything was, and I said, "Oh my God, I'm going to hit a wall," and we went right through the door. How I went through the door, I don't know, but I found myself on the outside of the apartment housing again. And so basically it just took me right through the door, and I just floated on the outside in the cold air. And the craft at that point, it must have been around 3 o'clock in the morning, was waiting at the base of the dam once again. It was waiting there, and I went inside the craft again, and this happened to me three times in a row. The second time, I told my mother that that something was happening to me, and that I was being taken at night, and I was actually going, you know, something was taking me into craft, but she couldn't understand what I was talking about, because the word UFO was barely coined, I guess, in what, 1949 or 47? Mm-hmm. And she had never heard of the term UFO, and I just told her, you know, there was a light taking me, and I was, you know, by the dam area, and so on the third night, she told me, when I was telling her, you know, she said, "Well, if it happens to you again, son, you're going to take your brother. They're going to take your brother." I said, "Well, what do you mean, Mom?" And she was making up the bed, and she stopped, and she took the bed sheets and ripped the bed sheets into long strips, and she tied my arm to my brother's arm and my leg to my brother's leg. And she said, if they come back for you, they're going to take you and your brother this time, because she had tied me to my brother's leg and his arm with the strips of the bed sheeting. And so around 5 o'clock in the morning, my mom was making breakfast for my dad, of course, to go to work, and I could smell the coffee and the bacon, and I saw the door open up, and she peeked in to check on us. And so we went through the whole thing of it taking me out to the craft again and coming back. But when my mother opened up the door to check on, I was tied underneath the bed on the actual, the legs of the bed. One leg was tied to one of the underside of the bed legs, the actual bed legs. And my one arm was tied to one of the other parts of the bed. So, they're not infallible. They made the mistake that they didn't retie me to my brother. They tied me to the underneath the bed, to the legs of the bed itself, and that's basically how my case started in 1952, until Dr. J. Allen Hynek, the founder of QFOS, later heard about my case in 1972, and I got to speak to him, and I considered myself very lucky, because I believe he was handpicked by President Gerald Ford to handle the UFO sightings in the early 70s, to find out exactly what was happening to all these different reports that were now coming in over the United States itself, these other abduction cases and a lot of childhood abduction cases that I understand through speaking to Dr. J. Allen Hynek. And he, in turn, put me in contact with MUFON, with the Epperson's, the Southern California director of MUFON in the mid 70s, and basically that's where I stood for a while until I had the military, when I joined the military, the Marine Corps, and that's when I had the second phase of my of my personal life and UFOs. I didn't know if I was, if you wanted to ask me a question, Preston, or because I think I did update you about, you know, the being taken aboard the bus with the windows blacking down. I don't know if you want to tell the listening audience where.
Let's just take a short station break. Hello, everyone. You're listening to UFOs and the Paranormal Over Our Heads. I'm your host, Preston Dennett. And tonight, our guest is Ruben Sierra. And he's talking about his incredible UFO encounters, which began in the early 1950s and continued throughout his life. And Ruben, I'm interested in, you know, whatever you want to feel comfortable talking about, but your experiences in the military, I think, are particularly interesting.
Yes. Did you want me to continue now? Was there a break, or did you want me just to continue?
Just go ahead and continue. Yeah.
Okay. Well, basically, when this started off in my early childhood, I was 6 years old when it started off, and every summer I would go down to Northern California, and I lived with my grandparents, and they were agricultural workers, and I would spend the summers by Fresno, California, and Hanford, Fresno, California area. It was kind of sort of like the breadbasket of California, the abduction started once again to take place at my grandparents' house in a little town called Layton, California, in between Fresno and Hanford, California. Mm-hmm. And this is a very small community. I think there was no more than maybe 300 people, if there was that. And the abduction started to take place over the summer in my mid-teens, when I would go down with my grandparents, and I had the exact same thing of them taking me from my grandparents' bedrooms where all the boys stayed, and take me to once again an awaiting craft. But one time, I asked my grandfather, had this big tall oak tree outside of his house, and he had like an army cot, and I asked him if I could stay outside and just, you know, sleep underneath the stars, basically. And I must have been around 15, 16 years old, and just prior to joining the Marine Corps. And I fell asleep underneath this tall oak tree that he had, and on top of the army cot. And I remember I had just gotten like a little somewhat of an argument with one of my male cousins, and and so I just kind of wanted to regroup myself and just get away from everyone. And so I got permission to stay outside that night. And the only thing I remembered, it must have been around 12:30 in the morning, because they went to a drive-in theater, and I saw them as they were pulling in, my cousins, they were pulling back and going to their house, and their country house. And I saw their high beams, and I glanced up off the cot, and I looked at them, and then I just went right back to sleep. And they parked their car, and they went back, and they did their thing after they went to a drive-in movie. And on the outside, while I was sleeping on top of the cot, I on the right side of the actual oak tree itself, the craft actually landed right next to the oak tree. And you have to understand, this is real country, a real country area. There's no lights, maybe one or two lights, street lights, for the whole area. So this is there was no nice houses. These were just country style houses. And I remember waking up, and I saw the craft on the right hand side of the oak tree, and the aliens at this time, they came close to me, and just, they were floating. They weren't walking. They were floating over the ground, and they made no attempt to communicate me whatsoever. They were just next to where I was sleeping, and they went across the field where my grandfather was. He had planted some cucumbers and the potatoes and corn and stuff like that, and the peach trees and for the family. And they went over there and they actually were taking vegetation. They were taking samples of the cucumbers, corn, and they actually destroyed his garden patch there. They didn't do it gingerly. They were just grabbing the cucumbers and potatoes and the corn, and they were just yanking them out of the ground. And I think they were just taking them back and forth inside the craft. Basically, they were trying to find out, I guess, what we ate, and they were just taking samples, vegetation samples, back into the craft. And
How did they carry them? Did they have bags, or did they just carry them in their hands?
Well, you know what? They had containers. They had like a container, and I remember them that they weren't walking, but they were putting them in a container, and each one had like almost like a bucket like container, and they were stuffing them in these like a bucket like container, but I could see them, and they weren't walking over the dirt or on the road itself. They were floating over, and they were going. They went to the craft, and they would just take it back and grab more, and fill up like these buckets. So those are about a good three of them that were doing this and going back into the craft, and then the craft just took off. In the morning, of course, since my cousins, when they came back from the drive-in theater, they saw me there, and they assumed that I went over there and.
Okay.
You know, tore my grandfather's garden up, and since I was arguing with one of my cousins, you know, the day before, and I was trying to explain what happened, and that didn't go anywhere. So the very next day, I told my grandparents that I was going to go down by the canals and just to get away from everything and trying to regroup my thoughts and stuff. So I went about a 2 mile walk where they had these irrigation canals, and I went up to the canal, and there was in that part of the Northern California, there's a lot of oak trees, and there was another oak tree there, and someone had put a rope on there, and then we would just swing across the canal and come back onto the bank of the hill over the water area, and then we would just let ourselves go and just go into the middle of this little a river type area of the canal itself. And so I was by myself, and I knew about this particular area because we would all play there, but I went by myself the next day because of the arguments about the vegetation. And when I was doing this on about the third swing, I came back on to the bank of the oak tree was, and I noticed at that time, Preston, that around, I'll say about 15, 20 feet away from the tree, I noticed that there was a black car there, like a long black car, and there were two men there, and they were standing next to the car, and this didn't make any sense to me because we as children we had a hard time resting our bikes against this particular tree because because of the layout of the land, there wasn't much room to walk, and how the car was right next to the tree there, I couldn't understand. I couldn't make, you know, it didn't make sense at all. It seemed like it was a black, brand new, mint condition automobile, and the men were dressed in suits.
There was no road there, right?
There was no road there. This was on the bank of the hill itself where the tree was and where the rope was as we would swing over the water and the bottom that would go down to the farmers, you know, like the cotton fields, you know, or the peach orchards. And then the farmers would take some, they had things where they would, water their fields, with, these plastic tubes. And they would shake them back and forth and draw water from the actual canal itself into their farmlands. Either they had peach trees or avocado trees, whatever they had there growing. And so as we, you know, I noticed the black car look almost something like a black service in between a limo and an executive's a black service limo. And there was two men there, and they were in these suits. They were very dark suits, and they were very, very tall, and they had a ruddy complexion, somewhat darker than an olive complexion, more of a ruddy look to them. They look more to me in between Russian and like a Chinese a look to them, And I said, well, I was trying to make, you know, heads or tails of this. So how could the car be there? There's not enough room for bikes, children's bikes. But it was there. And the men at that point, went back to the back of the automobile and they brought, a lady from there. And, she was wearing something like a cape. A dress, but a dark dress with a cape over the dress itself. And like I mentioned, this is just before I joined the Marine Corps. And I, you know, being a young man, I said, oh my, this is my lucky day. These guys are bringing this woman over here. And I said, what's this experience going to be about? And, but as they brought her closer to me and they pulled back the cape, you know, when they showed her face, it was just a horrendous looking alien being. It was more of the like a grasshopper. It's not a grasshopper. It's like a praying mantis type look. It was more like the with you have to help me here, Preston. Reptilian.
Oh, all right.
It had more of like the reptilian. Reports of reptilian aliens, and you know her face was more like a snake-like, you know, like the texture of her skin was more like snake skin. And so later on, after I spoke to Dr. Jale and Hynek, and I found out about the different types of aliens, I began to put two and two together. And when they brought her forward, and they pulled the cape off her head, and then I immediately fell backwards, and I started crawling away from that area, and I made my way back to the road, and then I tried to get back to my grandparents' house. So I think this is I'm not too sure if it was one of the first MIB reported cases, but now after speaking to Dr. Jalen Hynek just prior to his death, I think this was a man, MIB, Man in Black episode, basically.
Yeah. Now, backing up just a second, you know, the beings that took all the vegetables and fruit and stuff, what did they look like?
These were more of the grays.
Oh, okay.
You know, with the large heads,
uh-huh,
and the skinny bodies, large heads, they were not touching the ground whatsoever. They were floating on top of the ground, and they were just going back to where my grandfather had like a little log cabin type house on the other side of his property, where he had the vegetable fields and stuff over there. And, these were basically the grays, and, I vaguely remember saying they didn't want to communicate with me other than to say something like, you know, don't be afraid, you know, nothing's going to happen to you, don't be afraid. And I just kind of put my, you know, leaned over on my elbow and looked straight up at them, and they were just floating back and forth, bringing in the cucumbers and the potatoes and some of the corn that my grandfather had planted maybe 2 or 3 months, you know, before.
Right. And the encounter with the reptilian happened the very next day?
No. Yes, the very next day. Next day. Because I was still mad at my cousin who I had gotten into an argument, you know, and I wanted to kind of blow off some steam and get away by myself. And that's when I went back to the canal area. We used to call it the canal. Right. Basically, that's what it was, and that's when I had that experience. So I joined the Marine Corps when I was 17 years old. This particular episode happened when I was 16. When I was 17 years old, I wasn't doing all that well in school, and a lot of my friends were getting in trouble, and I just needed to kind of to get away, and I spoke to my parents, and I asked my father if he would sign for me to join the Marine Corps, and we talked about it for a couple of weeks, and then he agreed to sign me up if I would take the GED test, you know, the general, you know,
right.
The test for the high school diploma while you're in the service. It was a GED program that they had going. And so he signed me up, and I joined the Marine Corps in March the 30th of 1964, and to 1967. I stood 3 years active and 3 years inactive, and I reported to boot camp and at a Marine Corps recruit depot in San Diego Marine base. And so I after boot camp, I went to advanced infantry training, and then I went to I reported to my first duty station, which was headquarters and services, H&S, Marine Corps Base San Diego. And this seems, I think I mentioned to you when I first met you, Preston, this seemed somewhat odd to me because I could not figure out why I was given a position of office administration when I didn't finish high school. It just
right.
didn't make any sense to me. Remember when we first spoke about this? Well,
yeah,
I brought
yeah.
this to your attention. And
yeah,
I said, why, you know, my military, my MOS was, my military occupational status was office administration. And it just didn't make any sense to me. I said, you know, I didn't have a high school diploma. I was going to take the GED while I was in the Marine Corps. And it just didn't make any sense to me. But I, after boot camp and my advanced infantry training, I reported to headquarters and services, Marine Base, San Diego, and I that was my first duty station, and I reported in there, and so basically they assigned me a desk, and they told me that I would be, you know, doing some filing and some typing, and to just meet the other Marines there, and they would kind of show me around, and you know, the office, and tell me what to do, and around 3 or 4 days later, one of the sergeants came down, and he said that because of my position, I would need something that was called crypto clearance,
right.
And this was like a high type clearance. I remember him telling me that he was going to assign me crypto clearance number 4, and he said just in case anything would cross your desk, which was of a nature of a secretive nature or something like that, okay, that I would have to have permission to have, you know, to read it. And so I was assigned crypto clearance when I was in the Marine Corps at H&S, at headquarters and services. While I was there, and they gave me the paperwork for the clearance, and after about 2 weeks later, I noticed two of the Marines, two corporals, they were standing outside of the building itself, and I had walked outside, you know, outside of the building. I was going to go back to the barracks, and I overheard both of these corporals talking about a location where they had a UFO housed at a jet hangar. And that this particular jet hangar, the UFO had a blue glow to it, a high, very bright blue light on that was coming out of the craft itself. And that if you did not have any the proper clearance, they had two Marines on each side of the actual hangar doors itself, and they had M60 machine guns. So, you know, being that I had gone through advanced infantry training, I knew what an M60 machine gun was, and they had orders to shoot if you didn't have the clearance to get inside the building of the actual jet hangar itself. One thing that I wanted to bring to your attention again, Preston, was I think when they were talking about this, I think they were saying it so I could overhear them, that I could, you know, the way they were saying it, they wanted me to hear about this particular craft. They knew I was leaving the building, and they wanted to make sure that I would hear their conversation. That's the impression I got when I was listening to these two corporals that were assigned to headquarters and services with me. And
we're setting you up somehow.
Yes, that's what I believe now. And that's the same thing that Dr. Jalen Hynek felt. The same sergeant that got me the clearance at H&S, Headquarters and Services, he came about a week after that, and he gave us a little spiel about, you know, for the betterment of your country, and that there's a certain location, and we need some people to go down to this certain location, and this is something you would never forget. And he gave this long speech, and he was asking, I guess, for volunteers. And I remember my dad telling me, do your job as a Marine, but don't go volunteer for that stuff. So I don't remember volunteering for anything. The only thing I remember of having the listening to the sergeant asking for people to go to the actual jet hangar itself.
Right.
The very next day, they brought in a government, a naval bus, and I'm assuming it was naval. Could have been Air Force, but this will make more sense to Preston because it came out in his book. There was a bus came, and so I got on the bus. And there was about 11 Marines on the bus and myself, so I made the 12th Marine on this particular bus with the driver. And I was sitting, they sat me down towards right almost behind the driver on the right-hand side of the bus driver himself, and the other 11 Marines were sitting in their seats behind me. And the bus took off. But what I noticed, Preston, was the bus had a, the windows were blackened out.
Right.
And they were painted black with like a high, tint or just black paint. I can't remember, but the windows were just pitch black, and they had black curtains over the blackened out windows itself. So they didn't want us looking out, and they didn't want anyone looking into the bus itself. And that's when I first met Preston, and he told me of another case that he investigated where there was a, I believe it was an Air Force photographer, and he had found himself doing the same thing in another military bus with the windows blackened out. And that's how when I first met Preston, I said, oh, my God, you know, I'm not the only person this has happened to. But this other particular person, I believe he was an Air Force. He was Air Force personnel, and I was Marine Corps personnel. So that was the only difference. And so I know something was going on at that time because of what Preston, you know, what you made privy to me with in your book and this particular information. So as we were on the bus took off, and I remember going through all these different checkpoints from San Diego, H&S, Headquarters and Services, Marine Base San Diego. We took off into the desert area, and we went through all these different checkpoints, and I remember the bus driver becoming agitated. He was just, he was getting tired of going through all these different checkpoints. And he wanted to know the last location, and they would always tell him, well, just go down this one more checkpoint you have to go through. And then he became irate, and he said, you know, I just want to drop these guys off, you know. And he was getting quite upset, and I want this assignment over with. And lo and behold, we finally pulled up into the jet hangar where the craft was located inside the hangar itself. at this time, it must have been early morning once again. I'm assuming around at least 2 o'clock in the morning. And it was pitch black out, of course, because we were in the desert, and there was some military base we were on. It seemed military to me. And the hangar doors itself were completely open. We drove right up to the hangar door itself, and we began to disembark from the bus. And, because it was raining on the tarmac, on the ground, the road itself, I saw a blue glow. And the blue glow that I saw, it was because the glow was coming out of the actual hangar area itself, and it manifested itself on the tarmac itself. And then, I immediately remembered about the two Marines on each side of the hangar with the M60 machine guns. And,
right.
And I remember the conversation of these two corporals that were talking about that they had a UFO inside the jet hangar. And that's when I realized where I was at that point, you know. But just prior to that, getting to that area, I remember all the Marines behind me, everyone was in a stupor. Everyone was in a stern, their face. The other, no one was moving their heads. It looks like we were either drugged, and I was either given a lesser amount of the drug, because I could barely remember getting myself to move my head. But the other 11 Marines, they couldn't move their heads. They were just looking straight forward. And just before we got to this particular area, I would glance back, and everyone was wearing green fatigues, you know, just regular Marine Corps green fatigues. And then right after that, I would glance back again, and the Marines, we were wearing yellow jumpsuits. And this went on and off, until we pulled up into the jet hangar itself. So I don't know if, I later on found out that yellow jumpsuits, because the Marines are come up the Department of the Navy, and this means radioactive materials. So a radioactive material team that was also aboard the bus, brought aboard the bus to check us over before going into the hangar itself. That's what I'm assuming now. We went up. We got off the bus, and the sergeant that gave us the told us about, you know, this particular area. He was waiting for us there, and we got off, and there was a chair. There was some chairs there, and they gave us they drew blood from us one at a time. They took us like in team groups of three. And I remember they didn't call us by rank. They called us by our first name. But they said, "Hi, Reuben. I want you to remember, Reuben, whatever's going to happen here, you're going to be okay. And always remember, we're going to be here with you. And don't worry. Everything's going to be okay, Reuben." So they didn't call me by rank or the other Marines. They didn't address them by their rank at all. Everyone was addressed by their first name, which kind of struck me as somewhat being odd. They had some, doctors, because they were wearing, you know, a doctor's jacket, like a white smock type jacket, which the doctors wear. And, they were drawing blood, from us. And, back in the 50s, they would usually have these, when you were being hypnotized, they had this round circle that would just go around and around and around, something like a
barbershop pole type thing, or
something like that, like a barbershop pole. I remember telling you that, and we were trying to figure out the best way to say this. Yeah, like the barbershop pole, but it was, of course, it was just going flat and it was going around and around. And they brought this in front of us. I think they did that to put us into a relaxed state of mine, and I think when they drew the blood, I really don't know why they drew blood from us, to tell you the truth. I just know they drew blood from each and one of us. And then at that point, they took us by groups of three, and then they lined us all up, and we went inside the deeper into the hangar area itself. And there was like wall lockers there, and at the bottom of the wall lockers, they had these big hoses. And these big hoses, just like when there's a fire, an industrial fire, and you see the firemen shooting water at a building or whatever, there were big round hoses that were just like a fireman's hose, you know, when it's full of water. But they were big and round, and they were connected. They came from the bottom of these foot lockers, big giant transformers, condensers, and transformers. They were also by the foot lockers. And these big hoses ran up past the transformers up to the craft itself. At that point, the sergeant came back and he took myself and about two of the Marines, and they told the other Marines to stop and wait. And at that point, they took us as I glanced over the right-hand side of the transformers and lockers, that's when I first noticed the craft itself. I could see the top of it, of the craft, then I saw the actual shape of the craft itself. And then there was two additional Marines. And they came and they brought in one of the aliens to us. And these looked like the military aliens that I saw when I was a child. The ones with the black hoods. Remember I told you at the beginning of the program?
Right.
His garb was like military type garb. He was extremely, extremely tall, a lot taller to the Marines that were escorting him, one on each side. And they walked him to the group of Marines, of us 12 Marines. They were walking him towards us. Even though the other Marines were still somewhat in a drug state, I would say they when they saw this alien dressed like in military garb, it wasn't our garb, but you can tell you he was military. Then the formation broke up, and the Marines, and they were saying, "Oh, you know, I don't want to curse on the radio, but you know, oh hell no, you know. We're not going to go from this. Come on, you guys. We can take these guys. We can take these guys." And the formation broke up. The 12 Marines, they broke ranks, and they kind of got to their senses, and they were saying, "Come on, you guys. We can take these guys. We can take these guys." Immediately, wow. when it started to fall apart, there were other Marines that came over, and they took us all into a different a room. They all 12 Marines, myself included. They took us into different rooms and they began to interrogate us. So what I'm assuming now, Preston, I think this was one of the beginning stages to see if we could actually work with the aliens as far as military working with the aliens themselves. I think there was other Marines that were there before us and they just needed more people. And since they had a little more control of a headquarters and service, a Marine unit as opposed to a grunt unit, you know, like an extra fighting force unit. That's why I think they took us to this location to see if we could actually work with the actual beings themselves.
Mm-hmm. Quinn, I know you have a lot more to say, and gosh, I'd love to hear it, but our time is up.
Okay.
So we're going to have to wrap it up, but I really want to, I'm going to have you back on the show if you don't mind, because I know your story goes on for...
Yes, there's been some other things that, you know, that have been happening to me, and I'd be happy to come back into to the show again, Preston, and touch base with you.
Awesome, because I feel like we only just scratched the surface of your story. well, thanks, Ruben, for coming onto the show. It's great. Your story is very, very interesting and really quite remarkable.
Okay, I want to thank you for inviting me again, and I want to thank the listening audience, and I look forward to talking to you again, Preston.
All right. Well, everyone,
I want to thank you all for listening. You've been listening to UFOs and the Paranormal Over Our Heads. I'm your host, Preston Dennett, and tonight our guest has been Ruben Sierra. And we've been discussing his really incredible experiences with UFOs and extraterrestrials. And we're going to have him back on the show because we only got to when he was about just a teenager, and he's had a lot of experiences since then and are apparently still going on. So I want to thank you all for listening, and I hope you've enjoyed the show as much as I have, and I hope you can join us next week when I bring on another exciting guest on UFOs and the Paranormal. Until then, have a wonderful evening and a great week. Bye now.